My name's Franny. I'm an alcoholic. I'm so glad they had some other people get up here before me, so that at least I knew what the hell you do to speakers. You blew my socks off the first time you did it. You know, they do the same thing in Hawaii. I think it's just to keep these pompous speakers in their place myself. The person gets up ready to tell you what it's really like in Hawaii now. And they'll do something like, my name is George and I'm an alcoholic, you know, being cool. And everybody, there's all this power and they go, aloha! You know, and it just vibrates the hell out of you, you know, and I got cool about it finally because I lived in Hawaii and you just did it to me again, so I'll get even. Is this meeting over at 12 or at 11:30? Tell me the truth. Don't do that. You mean you're going to give me time to tell how sick I still was after I got sober? You want to know about that? You know, I don't think we talk enough about it. We sort of like give 40 minutes to all the drama, you know, getting here. Then we give about 10 minutes to get to what happens. And then you got 3 minutes of life is perfect. And then... And then you get down from the podium and nobody ever hears about how you met him after you had 2 months sober and your sponsor is saying you don't go to bed with anybody for a year. So you got 2 months and he has 10 months and that makes a year. Yeah, I think we're going to get along, yeah. Anyway, well, I already told you my name and my disease. And I just want to get some statistics out of the way. My father and my mother are both alcoholics. Also, I should warn you, somebody told me a long time ago, if you're ever going to speak from a podium, speak slowly and speak clearly, but we have a problem. I have a speech defect. I'm from New York. So, you know, just try to stay with me, okay? You already made me nervous, and I talk real fast when I'm nervous, so, actually. My father and mother are both alcoholics. My grandparents were alcoholics. My godfather was a New York policeman. He was alcoholic. The way he died was he was carrying a keg of beer down Paddy Glacken's steps down into the basement, helping him put the kegs of beer away in the tavern around the corner from our house, and he slipped and he fell down the stairs and the keg landed on top of him and broke his neck, and it was wonderful. They gave him a full military funeral from the New York Police Department, with the horses and the caisson and the police marching solemnly behind. And I said, you know, I wondered about that. I said, he died drunk. And my father said, no, he died in the line of duty. So they... he had his uniform on. I guess that made it. But anyway, I've been married 4 times. The first one was normal. He bored the hell out of me. Hey, I got to tell you something right now. Al-Anons are not normal. All right? You guys deserve us. God has put us in your lives so that you can work a wonderful program. There's a line in the big book that says that the alcoholic man has the uncanny ability to find a wonderful woman. And that's in the big book. So if he ever gives you a ration of shit, you just get the book and show him. How did I get off on that? I don't know. Anyway, the first one was normal. The rest were all drunks. The second one, and I'll get into him, he was a wet drunk. That one didn't work. But I have to tell you, if there's anybody here that's new, that's wondering if the gates of life clang shut and you never get to laugh again, not true. I found my next 2 husbands in an AA meeting. Okay? And I think anything doing well is worth doing poorly in the beginning. And what I did was my 4th husband is my best friend. We had a roaring fight last night right here in the other room. But the thing is it's okay to fight. The point is if you take it seriously, you got a problem, you know. So my problem is that he has a program too. I do love you. I can't stand you sometimes, but I do love you. Yeah. Anyway, I have four kids. And my oldest is a girl, and the rest are all boys. And my daughter is in ACA because, you know, she's still holding out. She doesn't want to admit she's like me. And the three boys are all sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to talk about that, too. I have some grandkids that are already showing the characteristics. I love to babysit them. They're so full of hell, I can't stand it. I lose at least a pound and a half every time I babysit, so it's great. Running around after them. You know, I drank four times before I was 21, and every time I drank, I got drunk. First time I drank, it's part of the story. First time I drank, I was 5 1/2 years old. No big deal, except that I was carrying a tray of drinks in for my father's friends at a party, and I tasted one of the drinks, and I liked it. So I came back, and I told my sister Ann was helping me. She's a year younger than I am. And I told Daddy, I said, we can carry more. You know, Daddy, we can carry more. You know, we were so cute. And so he gave us, I don't know what, and the two of us, instead of making a right turn into the living room to the guests, walked straight into the closet at the end of the hall and drank everything on our trays. Okay? So we passed out. Now, the thing I have to tell you is my father was, to put it nicely, a gangster in New York. My mother panicked because she couldn't find the girls. We lived in Midtown Manhattan, not the best, I mean, certainly it was brownstones, you know, and you get out on the street, two little kids like that, God knows what's going to happen. So my mother freaked out, and she absolutely insisted on calling the police to look for the girls. Hey, well, you know, my father and his friends were not the kind of people that wanted the police coming to the house. So it broke up my father's party, so he was pissed off, you know, and they didn't find us, and my mother was absolutely hysterical, and Annie and I came wandering out of the closet the next morning, sick, sober, and sorry, you know. What are you going to do? You got these two kids, and they're standing there, remorseful. You pick them up, you put them right here, you look them right in the eyeball, and you say, Franny, you got to cool it, you drink too much. What else are you going to do? Actually, what happened was my family did the thing that so many families do, and I'm going to be talking about families. They made a funny story out of it. And then what we used to do is we used to tell these funny stories about each other's drinking escapades when we were sitting around Thanksgiving or sitting around Christmas. And those parties usually went to hell in a handbasket because somebody would pick up the turkey and throw it at somebody because they told a story they didn't want to hear. I'll never forget the Christmas my grandmother got so excited she fell into the Christmas tree. And she's a little fat woman, you know, and we couldn't pick her up, and she was screaming the lights were burning her, and everybody's panicking. But you see, my father had been drunk when he put the tree up, and he'd nailed the tree to the floor. And isn't that an alcoholic life? I mean, you know, we learned how to communicate with eye signals and eyebrows and, you know, when I was in high school, I was the oldest girl, and I had a mouth, you know, and I used to get mad when my father started going after my sister Ann, because she was sort of the sickly one. I used to tell her she was sexy and sickly, and she used to tell me I was built like a shoebox. So, you know, we were very nice to each other, and anyway, and my sister Pat used to just sit there playing with her dolls and watch the two of us tear the hell out of each other and cut up each other's clothes. And I mean, we were insane. It was a total insane family. But my mother learned how to, we never said Daddy was a drunk. Never. We never said anything like that. What we would say is, what my mother would say is, she'd get the third phone call. He's not home yet, right? But the third phone call. And by then you can tell, you know, he's sort of slurred. He's only around the corner. And I used to sit in my bedroom and I used to look out the window and wait for him and watch him. And I could tell when he walked down the street, the straighter he walked, I knew the drunker he was. And then he'd come in the house, and he'd close the door, and he'd pass out in front of the door, and we couldn't get out. So Annie and I used to climb down the fire escape, no big deal. And but I was looking out the window, and I couldn't see my father, and my mother come into me, and she'd say, you girls finished your homework, didn't you? And, oh, yeah. Would you like to go to the movies tonight? I have a couple of extra bucks. we knew what she was doing was getting us out of the house so that when he came home, he didn't have any target, because this is what he used to do. And we'll see if anybody here has done that. How many people here have an alcoholic parent? And if you have two alcoholic parents, raise both hands. Take a look around. You know? Let me tell you something about that. My father was wonderful when he wasn't drinking, but when he was drinking, he was an absolute beast. And I spent an awful lot of my life trying to prove that I didn't drink the way he did. And I nearly killed myself doing it. Because in order to drink not the way he drank, that meant that I had to drink successfully. That meant I had to drink as much as he did and not do the things that he did. And you know what? I never beat it. I never made it. Because what happened to me was when I drank, I did what he did. You know, I was just an animal. And so enough with that. The next time I drank, I got drunk. I was 14 years old, and I wound up coming home because I felt sick. And I went in my bedroom, and I closed the door, and I realized I couldn't find the light switch. I got myself turned around. And that was when I learned that, you know, have you ever gone to bed when you've been so drunk that everything's spinning, and you have to put one leg out and put it on the floor to hold the bed still so it won't slide right out? No, you gotta sort of like hold the mattress down. I found out about that when I was 14 years old. That's the second time in my life I drank. I also had to go to the bathroom and I had to puke. I gotta be honest. One thing I will tell you is that I get sick and tired of going to these meetings. I've gone to meetings where somebody says, well, it's Myrtle M. And somebody says, oh, a woman speaker? Oh, well, let's go for coffee. And I want to tell you why that happens. Because when the guys come in and get the program, they get sobriety. And for women, in many cases, they come in and they get the program and they get respectability. And they clean up their act, but they not only clean up their act, they clean up their story. And all of a sudden, they sound like somebody who doesn't even deserve to be an Al-Anon. And they're boring. And not only that, but, you know, you've heard about lies of omission. So if any of you are expecting lies of omission, leave now. Because I don't want to sully your virginal ears. Anyway, what happened was I really did. I had to go to the bathroom real bad, and I had to vomit. And I couldn't get out of my own bedroom to find the bathroom. So anyway, I took care of both processes, and I tried to clean it up as best I could. And I fell on the bed, you know, and that's when I did the thing about putting my foot out and hanging on to it. And it was a horrible feeling. But it wasn't horrible enough for me to even anticipate not drinking again. Because the flight was wonderful. It was just the landing was shit, you know. Anyway. My mother came in the next day. I don't know why, it was about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I maybe earlier than that. I had a part-time job, and I worked on Saturdays in the morning. And she came walking in, and I'm sitting on the bed, and I looked at her, and she looked at me, and she didn't move a muscle in her face. She just looked at me, and it was like, and that's the first time I ever saw the Al-Anon face, you know. You know, they look at you, and they don't say anything, and their lips are straight. They show you nothing. And it wasn't until I took my fifth step with my sponsor, and I told her about that, you know, and it always, you know, it was like, why didn't she ever say anything to me about it? Even after I got sober, even after she got sober, nothing, ever. And my mother said to me, that face, I mean, my sponsor said to me, that face, you know why you see that face? Why they don't say anything? I said, no, why? She said, because your father was at the height of his drinking and right in the process of killing himself. And from what you say, your mother loved him dearly. I said, that's true. That's true. He was the love of her life. Okay. And what happened is she walked into that room and here's her oldest daughter, her Hope, looking and smelling exactly like him. At the age of 14, she said, I want to tell you something. She said, Franny, the agony is inexpressible. There are no words. There's nothing to say. And I thought, okay, I got it. But I didn't know that until I was sober. The thing I did figure out was that when you are in a situation as a drunk where somebody's got you, you're just wrong, you just screwed up completely. I mean, first of all, if there's anybody here planning on going out again, I'm going to give you some advice. If you find yourself with somebody in your face like that, first of all, don't argue. That only makes them mad. It prolongs the embarrassment and the argument. Don't justify yourself. They'll prove you're wrong. Don't apologize, because then they got you and you're going to hear it for an hour. Okay? What you do is you stand there and you look at them with no expression on your face until they run down from frustration and walk away. And see, I learned how to do that. I learned how to outweigh them. I learned how to outweigh my husbands. I learned how to outweigh all those people that were there in my face saying things like, "What's the matter with you? Don't you love us anymore? Why are you doing these things?" Like I had an answer. I'm an alcoholic. It's a grave mental and emotional problem. It's a physiological situation, and I have a mental obsession. Is that answer enough? I mean, did I know that? No, of course not. I had no idea what it was. So anyway, what I did was I simply outweighed them. The next time I drank, I got drunk and I got pregnant. And the next time I drank, I got drunk and I got married. So I should have known I had a problem with booze. If you'd said something to me about, "Franny, why do you do this?" I would have said, "Hey, I'm just learning how to handle it." So I would have said, "I only drank four times. What's the big deal?" You know, you nearly caused a riot in New York. You caused incredible pain and fear for your mother. You got yourself knocked up. And now you're married to a man that you at best like. And you think that's not a problem? So anyway, what happened was, he was okay. He really was. He was just very dull. I mean, he was so normal. He was so square, he was a cube, you know? And I need to report that he eventually, after we got divorced, he married the babysitter, and she was a lot like me, only less so. He did want somebody that had some energy. He just didn't want that much. So anyway, what happened was we moved to California to avoid the scandal, moving on with the story, and we got to North Hollywood, and I found myself in a split-level trap. All these women were there. I had about six friends on the street, and we used to get together every Wednesday afternoon for coffee clutch. We all had 3.4 kids. The high social point was some kid got the chicken pox, and we throw a party, so all the other kids got it. We got that out of the way. Measles, the same thing. Definitely make sure that all the girls had German measles before they started school, you know. The women in the neighborhood had a network, and as soon as one kid had a disease that your kid hadn't had yet, get them over there, play. Go play. You know. And that's what we did. And, you know, and the husbands got in the car and went into L.A. every day to work. And we stayed home and played house. And other than the Wednesday afternoons, we were busy just running around chasing our 3.4 kids. I started wondering about it. I said, "Is this all there is?" And one of my girlfriends said, "Yeah." I couldn't figure it out. And, it was a pretty typical community. I couldn't figure it out. I really couldn't. And this was in the 50s. And I started getting angry. The other thing that happened was that I really felt like you had all the information and I didn't have it. Listen, let me tell you something. You know the day before you're born, when you're in the briefing room, you know, when they're getting you ready to be born, and everybody's sitting around? When I was in that briefing room the day before I was born, I had to go to the bathroom. So I went out and I went to the bathroom. And while I was out of the room, that's when they came in and gave them the owner's manuals for being a human being. There's a lot of heads going like this right now. And what happened was, and they left with one left over, but it was probably a miscount. And when I came back, I said, "Where's my book?" And they said, "You don't get one. You weren't here. You should have been here. So you missed. You lose." And so I had to get born without an owner's manual. So everybody else around me knew the rules, and I never knew the rules. See, they'd go away when nobody was looking and look it up. And I was afraid to ask you, what's going on? Because I knew that if I asked you for some information, that you would know I never got an owner's manual. You would know I was a loser. So I never let on to anybody that I didn't know. And I paid real good attention in school all the way through, and I got real good grades, and nobody ever told me about being a human being. So I watched other people, and the thing I noticed was I didn't always laugh at the same time other people laughed, and I didn't always cry the same time other people cried. And it was like I was off kilter. But I couldn't ask, because if I did, then you'd know I was off kilter. And you tell me, go away. See, you're not one of us. You're one of them. So I never let on. And when the other ladies had the coffee clutches, I would watch, and I, you know, it was so dull is what it was, you know. I mean, none of us had any. We pooled our boredom, and only came up with one big boredom. You know, it's just. I went to a Catholic priest one time up at the church, because I mean, I said, I don't understand this. And I was really angry by this time. I said, I don't understand this. If all I'm supposed to do is be a brood cow, why do you guys educate us? Women, I mean. And he looked me right in the eye and he said, so that you won't raise ignorant boys. Didn't you know? And because I knew I didn't have the manual, I didn't question it. I only resented it. The resentment was turning into a rage about what was going on in my world. The resentment was turning into a total rage, and I wouldn't admit it, but what I did notice was that when I had a couple of drinks, it quieted it. It got quiet. And what I also noticed was that I really resented you because you knew what was going on and I didn't. But when I had a couple of drinks, I could tolerate you. And at the same time, it's almost like I was more competent, like I was more of a human being when I had a couple of drinks. So what happened was, when it was my turn to have the coffee clutches, instead of doing the coffee and sweet rolls, what I did was, at the age of 21, I want you to know this, I'm serving cream sherry in little crystal glasses and sweet biscuits because that was more sophisticated. And the thing is that when the other women went home, I would finish the cream sherry, and if I had bought two bottles just in case, and the deal was, I was very tidy. I never left any booze, okay? And my husband used to come home and he'd find me on the couch checking my eyelids for light leaks. You know how that goes. And he would say, well, you know, once a month, what's the problem? And he would take the kids to that new place, McDonald's. That's how long ago we're going. And the kids thought it was fun. He thought it was fun. It was real nice. Give mommy a break. But the truth of the matter is, first of all, that's a candy-ass way to start the story that I'm going to be telling you. And the second thing is, that was the very beginning of my family accommodating to my disease. See, you don't know where it starts, but sometimes if you stay sober long enough, and you do enough work with the steps, and you listen to enough fifth steps yourself, you start identifying and you start seeing what patterns are. And you know what happened was, that was the first time that my family, my own family, started accommodating to my disease. No big deal. Except that I was not capable of being a wife and a mother, and they had to do something different than what they were used to doing. They started accommodating. We bought some property. That man that I married at that time, he really was nice. He was steady. He was stable. He was an L.A. fireman. He was doing everything right. He wanted to have a house. He wanted to have a picket fence. He wanted to have a couple of kids. He wanted to have a dog, a cat, and he wanted to have a wife that he could bring his paycheck home to, and that's where it fell apart. Because what happened was, my intention was to have a party, to stay in the party, to stay as long as I could in the party, and I didn't want to do anything else. And I figured as long as I didn't hurt anybody, it was okay. The problem was, is I was hurting people, and when they complained to me about it, I would tell them they were whining. So, we bought some property down at the beach. We moved down to the beach, and again, it's the same thing, the split-level trap. And I went down on the beach one day, and I'm still wondering what's going on. And I saw this group of people down there, and I thought to myself, my God, who are they? They had, they were barefooted. This is the early 60s. They're barefooted. They had bell-bottom hip huggers, and the guys had vests with no shirts, and they had long hair, and they had hairbands. And the women had these peasant skirts. God, I don't know where I got them, Romania or someplace like that. And peasant blouses, and they had seagull feathers and flowers in their hair, and they all looked a little disheveled, and they looked like they were as happy as they could be, and they were passing these funny cigarettes around, and I watched them. And you know what? They looked like they were okay inside themselves. They looked like they were cool. Only I didn't know the word at the time. They looked content. They were smiling, even when nobody was looking. And you know, there was a... there was an attraction about them. And I walked over to them, and I introduced myself to them, and I introduced my kids, and I asked them where they knew in the area, and what I found out was that they weren't interested in where my husband worked. They didn't give a hoot what kind of a house we lived in. They didn't know what kind of schools my kids went to. It was like they were on a higher level. And I thought, these people are wonderful. I was so attracted to them. So I went home, and I threw away my purses, and I threw away my high-heeled shoes, and I threw away my gloves, and I threw away my hats. And in 6 weeks, I was down there, hairy, happy, and hippie, too. And I loved them. And I had some responsibilities. I wasn't willing to take on the responsibilities in my own home, but I had a big responsibility to the group. See, I had always lived on the coast, if not the Atlantic, the Pacific, other than that hell interim in North Hollywood. But what I did was my job was to figure out exactly where to bury the half gallon of wine with the brown paper bag on it so that it would stay cool enough to keep the wine nice, but not so wet that the bag would slough off. Now, maybe it's different here in Montana. I have traveled around the world and I've always looked. Why is it when you put a brown paper bag on something, it immediately turns into Coca-Cola? Have you ever noticed that? You ever noticed these guys with a beard with a brown paper bag? They drinking beer? No, automatically. You're assuming Coca-Cola, right? Otherwise, somebody would stop them, right? Well, will somebody tell me where they sell Coca-Cola in half-gallon jugs? I never saw it. But we used to put a brown paper bag on it, and we'd take swigs, and the police never stopped us. It was Coca-Cola. I don't know. The world is crazy sometimes. But anyway, that was my job, and my husband came to me one time, and he said, "What are you doing? What's going on here?" I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Look." He said, "You think these people are friends of yours? They're not. They're only using you. You're the only one that's got somebody that's stupid enough to go to work and support this whole movement." He said, "I got to tell you something." He said, "I can support my family, but I can't support the tribe." I, on the other hand, had been learning a new vocabulary, and I looked at him and I said, "Hey, don't get heavy." You know, and he was starting to be real unhappy with the way our life was going, and he wanted me to straighten my act up, and the truth of the matter is I was bored with him, and only because he was going to work every day, and he wanted to be a parent, and like I said, I certainly didn't. You know, the kids were sort of there. And what happened was I started screwing around on him with some of my interesting friends. And the other thing that happened was that I quickly moved from the hippies to the guys who supplied them with the drugs. Because these men were much more attractive. Where the hippies were sort of cosmic, these guys had an edge. They had a dangerous edge. And I got to tell you the truth, I love dangerous men. Okay? I am 21 years sober. I love dangerous men. All right? And these guys had an edge. And what I learned real quick was that you didn't whine. You didn't try to manipulate. You learned how to hold your face straight. You learned how to be cool. You got to go to interesting places. You never told them when you're hurt, and you certainly never told them when you were scared. And you never asked for help. Because if they knew you were vulnerable, you could get your throat cut and your money taken in a hot minute. Those were the kind of guys that I had succeeded. And what I did was I skittered around the pool, putting my toes in occasionally with these people that were absolute sadistic criminals. and I try to maintain my own sense of what I thought was right. And the truth is, if you start hanging with pigs, you start smelling like a pig. See? And what you wind up doing is you start compromising one little thing here and one little thing there, and sometimes just so you can get home without getting thrown out of the car. And what I wound up doing was compromising eventually to the point where it no longer looked like a compromise, and I simply went along with whatever was coming down. And that's where I had gotten myself, just based on my own desire, based on my own self-will. And I thought I was cool. And I had gotten hard, and I had gotten just a little brittle. You know, and I had the answers, and I had more than, hey, don't get heavy on me for that old man. And you know, he's wondering, he's the one who laid those lines on me, like, where's my wife? And who the hell are you? What kind of devil are you? I mean, where's the girl I married? Where's the lady that's the mother of my children? Why don't you leave and send her back? And he's folding and unfolding a kitchen towel with tears streaming down his face, looking at me, asking me. He said to me, don't you love us enough? I mean, what are we doing wrong? What can we do to change? We will do anything. We just want Franny back. And I have to tell you, Franny was gone. And that's where I stood there looking at him, waiting for him to run down. So when he went away, I could have another drink. That's how fast it took. And he came to me on July 8th, and he said to me, listen, Buddy's 8 years old today. He's my oldest son, my absolute favorite. He said, Buddy's 8 years old today. I want to have a birthday party. You've turned into a slut. You've turned into a sot. You know, I can't count on you for anything. He said, but could you please give the kid a birthday party? And I said, yeah, why not? What's the big deal? I mean, you buy crepe paper, you get a cake, you know, you go out, you bring the kids in, they play a little bit, you know. Then you open the presents. Everybody says, ha, 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 ho, ho, ho. Send them home. You had the birthday party. No big deal. Right? So he says, I'm coming home at 3 o'clock this afternoon. I want the house clean, which would have called for heavy-duty equipment, for God's sake. But he says, I'd like to have the house in order anyway, and I want the kid to have a birthday party, because Buddy really wanted his birthday party. So he went off to work to come home at 3 o'clock, and I immediately took the kids and went down the pier and went to Tony's on the pier and sat there talking to my friend Kenny, because after all, you have to plan these birthday parties, right? And there was some guy sitting down at the end of the bar. I don't know who he was. I never did say a word to him. But he was trying to make a move on me, and he wound up buying 151 Mai Tais for me all day. So by the time my husband walked in about 3:15, I'm drunk, of course. And he dragged me off that bar stool, and he dragged me kicking and screaming down the pier in front of all my fine friends that were out there fishing and spitting, and down to the end of the pier, and here's the kids watching to see what Daddy and Mommy are going to do now. And have you ever been so drunk that you knew that you really had to get on your dignity, but you couldn't find it? You know? Well, that's sort of where I was. And I somehow or other I knew what was happening was wrong. Well, I used to get drunk two ways. I would get drunk mentally. Let me tell you the first one. First one is where your body gets drunk and your mind doesn't, so you think you're as clear as a bell until you have to get up from the bar and you realize you can't find your feet. You know, that's the physical drunk. And then there's another drunk, that's the mental drunk, which is usually a blackout where your brain turns off and your body's still working, particularly your mouth. That's the one that used to get me in trouble. And so what happened was I had the physical drunk. I felt like I knew what I was doing, but he dragged me all the way down there. And I tried to, like, get maintain some kind of dignity, and I couldn't do it. And I pulled some money out of my pocket, and I gave it to my daughter, who was 9, and I said, Annie, buy the kids some ice cream and then walk home, because it's only 2 blocks. And we'll have Buddy's party. I just don't want to have you kids watch your father abuse your mother this way. So he poured me in the car. I mean, he was... And we got home, and... I don't know who answered the phone. But what I do know is I had the phone to my ear, and my daughter was saying, who's 9? Annie is saying, Mommy, we don't know what happened exactly. We bought the ice cream, and Buddy was sitting on the railing of the pier, and he was eating his ice cream, and I guess his hands were slippery, and I don't know whether one of the kids pushed him or he slid off, but anyway, he went over backwards into the water, and we can't find him. So, I can tell you that I was absolutely shocked into total presence. I was there. I can tell you that women can lift automobiles, which, by the way, I have done. I can tell you that there is a power that happens when you're focused. That's unbelievable. And I was like totally focused. I was not drunk any longer. I put him in the car. I drove us back down to the beach. And I happened to be a hell of a swimmer. And I started running down the beach. And this big, fat Samoan friend of mine grabbed me. And he, like, flipped me around and pushed me down into the sand and held his hands on my shoulders and said, "God, Franny, don't you find him." And he held me kneeling there in the sand watching the water while the men swam back and forth on the pilings on the pier until one of my friends walked out carrying the body of my son, my birthday kid. And all of a sudden, there were, like, police, fire department, lifeguards, all these colors and all these lights and all these officials, and they were working on him. And I was over here, and I was trying to get to him. I wanted to get my hands on my kid. And they wouldn't let me. They wouldn't let me. And then the next thing I know is we had him in the ambulance, and we were following the ambulance up to South Bay Hospital. And they had him in the emergency room, and they had him on a resuscitation unit. And my husband is standing on that wall in the hallway outside the emergency room, and he's got his arms folded, and he's leaning back against the wall, and he's looking at me. And I got my arms folded just the same way, and I'm leaning on my wall, and I'm looking at him. And the two of us are standing there staring at each other while we're waiting to find out whether our birthday kid is alive or dead. We had reached the point where we couldn't even hold each other. I mean, I could have given more kindness to a stranger. And he was no longer concerned for me. We stood there like isolationists, watching each other, waiting. We were not there for each other. That's what my drinking and my behavior had done to that family. And what happened was, while I was standing there, you know, I gotta tell you, there are no atheists at a time like that, because you bargain. First you negotiate, then you bargain. First you deny, then you bargain. Then there's an anger. And then there's despair, and then there's acceptance. And what happened was, my denial lasted until I was in that hospital listening to that machine working on my kid and watching my husband. And I went in and I said, "Hey God, don't take this baby because I'm an incompetent human being. Don't kill him because I'm a rotten mother. I mean, if you're going to take anybody, take me. Nobody would give a shit. You would be doing the world a favor if you took me. Nobody wants me. I'm no good for anybody." I had reached the point in my drinking where if I was like a papier-mâché mannequin, and if you pushed your finger through, the only thing that you would have would be a bad smell coming out. And I knew that. And I said, "Don't take him. He loves life. He's good." And then I did the thing that people do. I went in and I found what I could negotiate for the life of my kid with. And I came and I stood before my Creator and I said, "I will even quit drinking if you let this kid live." And when I told that to my sponsor, when I took my fifth step, she said to me, "Franny, according to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we really don't tell anybody that they're alcoholic. It's like every person has to assign themselves." She said, "But I'm going to tell you something. You are an alcoholic." And she said, "And the reason I'm saying that is because anybody who would go in and find what was most precious to them to negotiate for their favorite child and bring up a goddamn bottle of booze has got to be an alcoholic. And the thing I'm saying to you is if you have ever been in a life-threatening situation, or if you have ever stood before a higher power and said, 'If you do this, I will even quit drinking,' you're an alcoholic. Because that's what we negotiate with." That's what I did. In the meantime, the doctor came out and he said, I'm sorry, he's gone. Okay. And I took my husband home, and he fell apart. And I cooked supper. Because, you see, in the world that I had finally succeeded in creating for myself, you don't ask for help. You don't say please. You don't admit to any weakness. You certainly don't talk about being in pain. So I took care of that family. And you know that man came to me 2 months later, and he said, you are some kind of monster. In the entire time since Buddy died, you haven't cried. I've talked to psychologists about you. I've talked to psychiatrists. I talked to the priests up at the church. And as far as they're concerned, I also, by the way, he and I were in counseling, and I had gone through some psychological testing with two different psychiatrists, neither one which knew the other one was doing Catholic deviant. And according to the Catholic Church, that means you were born with no soul. See, so when I had that information, I didn't care. I was a psychotic. I was absolutely without any moral sense. I was a survivor. I would wind up either at the top of the heap or in jail for life. That's what happens to those kind of people. So what happened was this husband said, here's what I'm doing. I'm taking the kids away from you. I'm divorcing you. You're never going to see me or the kids again. And I stood there looking at him, and I said, you can't do a thing until the divorce is final. So get out of my face. So he went, and he got real serious, and he started moving on that divorce. And in the meantime, here I stand with these little kids. I don't have any control anymore. I'd never had any internal control. And all of a sudden, what we have now is the man is gone. I can drink the way I want, and by God, I did. And nobody stopped me. Because if they did, what I did was I would say to them, I've had a double tragedy in my life, and you're so inconsiderate, you're telling me I can't drink. It's the only way I can feel good. And I milked the situation to death. My drinking intensified so much it was unbelievable. And I want to tell you something. It was not because I lost my kid and because my old man divorced me. It was because I was an alcoholic and there were no more controls and now I could drink the way I wanted. See, we don't drink because of the situation. We use the situation to drink. And what happened was I looked up one day and it was 2 years later and, you know, somehow or other we got the divorce and I got the kids because I had a lawyer that lied and he taught me how. Not that he had to work very hard. And here I am, and I got these little kids, and I gotta get a job. So with this keen intellect and this fine mind, I went out and I found the best job that I could find. And I was a barmaid in a beer bar. And I was wiping the bar down one day, and this guy came slithering in. He was a Cherokee Indian. But he didn't tell me that. He told me he was German. He had a German accent. Hey! We got great stories, right? So what happened was, what the deal was he was a waiter, and he'd been a waiter all his life. And he was about as smart as I was in some ways. And what he noticed was that the European waiters got better tips. So he developed a German accent that was so complete, even when he talked in his sleep, he had a German accent. He danced the way I did. He played pool the way I did. He drank the way I did. He was as crazy as I was. And ladies, when you find a gem like that, what do? You marry him. 9 months later, I had another kid. And when that baby was 6 months old, that man is standing there in the doorway looking at me saying, I can't take it. I'm gone. I can't take your game. I can't take your act. I'm gone. And he laughed. Hey, I had to do something to get his attention. I had to do something to snap his garter. And I remembered that my mother used to call AA on my father. So I called AA to turn him in. See, I knew if he would behave himself, we wouldn't have any problems. And what happened was they told me that they don't do those kind of 12-step calls anymore and that the person that needed the help had to ask for it. But the guy that was on the other end of the phone was chatting with me for a bit. And, you know, I was always drunk by this time. And he must have heard something in my voice because he said, why don't you come on up? We got a 7 o'clock beginners meeting and you can get some information and then you'll know how to get him here next time. It made absolute sense to me. So I put on my 79-cent pair of Zoris because I wore them for special occasions. and I put on a camel colored corduroy pair of pants that fit me. That made them mine. And I was so mean. I used to put on other people's clothes and they'd say, "Hey, that's mine." I'd say, "So?" They'd say, "Oh, it's okay," and they'd walk away. I put on a man's shirt that had a button missing, but I pinned it discreetly from the back, you know, maintain propriety. And I put on a sweater that I'd stolen from Goodwill because I couldn't afford to buy it. Now, I want to give you some advice. If you're planning on drinking again, camel is the color. I'm wearing it today. Because if you throw up on it and you brush it off, it doesn't show too much. And if you fall in the mud, it doesn't show too much. You know, I was so broke when I came in, but I was such a snob. One time my sponsor told me, she said, "Franny, tell these girls how you get 4 days out of a sweatshirt." And I said, "Easy, front, back, inside out, front, back." I thought people really wanted to hear that. I think she used to do things like that to me. She used to do things like that to me because she was trying to make a point. I never got it. Never. Anyway, I got myself up to the meeting. I put 25 cents in that big beater that I was driving, and I got myself up to the meeting, and I stood outside, and I watched, and I saw the way they came in and put money down and went in, and I went over the other window, and I saw them all standing there and sitting around and chit-chatting with each other. I figured, yeah, I can do that, no problem. And the other thing that I had done is I had also dropped a roll of bennies and washed it down with a cup of Irish coffee that was more Irish than coffee, and I had... was that the time I ate my daughter's marijuana plant? I don't know. Anyway, that might have been another time. But anyway, what happened was I was stabilized. And I walked into that meeting ready for anything. And I sat there because I was looking for the president so I could tell him about Parnell, my husband. And this guy named Frank P. came out and he talked about a half an hour about the god-awful stuff I ever heard in my life, you know. He talked about the burning the house down. No, he talked first about them running away with the mailman and everybody laughed. Then he talked about burning the house down. Everybody laughed and clapped. And I thought, my God, these people are weird. I really did. I was morbidly fascinated. You caught me. I was morbidly fascinated. But the thing that was really interesting was, remember I told you that I always had to watch people to see how they laughed and see how they responded? Well, I would... He said some things, and I would go, but I was, and I'd look around, and you were all going, ready to, you were on the same schedule I was. And I knew you were sick. I knew, because I knew I was. I didn't know what the hell was the matter with me, but I knew I was sick. And all of a sudden, I'm surrounded by people who laughed at the same time I did. Have you ever been in a movie where there's something wild going on up on the screen, and you're laughing and scratching so hard you can't stand it, and you suddenly realize that yours is the only voice you hear? Have you heard that? Well, that's what happened to me my entire life, and all of a sudden, we're all on cue. I said, something is up here. And then when he got finished, he said, okay, that's enough of that. Now it's the time for questions and answers. And I thought, I knew. I had one question to let you know that it wasn't my fault, it was him. So I said, how do I get my old man to stop beating me? It's him. Say it's him. And he said, well, I haven't had any old man beat me since I got sober. And actually, the real wording was, I haven't had anybody else's old man beat me since I got sober. And, I said, and he said, but, he says, I think one of the ladies should answer that question, and we got Indian Genie over here. Indian Genie, you come on up and you share a little experience, strength and hope with this lady. So Genie bellied up to the podium. And she said, my name's Genie. And I'm an alcoholic. And any some bitch that lays a hand on me now that I'm sober is gonna get a knife right in the gut.
Ed. Hot dog. These people have the answers.
And I stayed for that meeting, and I stayed for the next meeting, and I stayed for the wrist flashers meeting, and... You know, the midnight meeting. Everybody whines because they're alone. And they poured me out of the club, you know, at due time. And I went home, and I went in my kitchen, and I opened my drawer, and I found the biggest vegetable knife I had. And I washed it, and I steel-wooled it, and I polished it, and I dried it, and I put it right there on the counter so that when he came home, I could introduce him to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he did, and I had that knife right under his neck, and I am backed up against the wall in the kitchen, and I'm saying things like, and I'm a child of God, and A&A, and you can't, and I pulled it back to get a reaction, and he split. Fine. And for that weekend, I went to every meeting I couldn't. Before you knew it, you know, I found my crowd. I went in, and they said, find people you identify with, and I said, okay. And I found them. None of us had over 3 minutes of sobriety. And you know, there were these idiots up there. You know, they'd get off work. I mean, we would hang around the club. I mean, who would hire us, first of all? And anyway, I couldn't stand my kids and I couldn't stand my house. And so I'd say, I'm going to AA. Like, and God will take care of my children. God did. Not through any plan of mine, believe me. And I used to get up there to the club, and the thing is that my people stood outside. And we dragged our heels and popped our fingers and talk about, oh, this program's heavy. Yeah. You know, we were profound. And we watched these other people going in and going up the steps of the meeting and coming back and, you know, well, they were idiots. You know, what did they know? But we were down there discussing the verities of life, for God's sake. And what happened was we kept getting drunk and I couldn't figure it out. And so then I started going in the meetings. But you see, here's what happened to me. I'm the lady that killed my kid. You come up to me and you say things like, come on, let's sit down. Let's talk a little bit. Let's find out who you are and what you're about. You know, let me tell you. I wasn't going to let anybody near me because I knew who I was. See, I'm the one that didn't have any soul. I'm the one who stank when you pushed your finger through the paper mache. I'm the one who did the things that I did with those gangsters. I'm the one who stood in a bar on Artesia Boulevard one time, which is Sleazeville, and negotiated with my buddy, the salesman behind the counter, my best friend, whatever his name was, and I said, and you know, trying to just negotiate for a little booze, and he said to me, Franny, he said, I'm sorry, you're not worth a half a pint of scotch. See, I'm the one that sat under the pier with a long stick, keeping the rats away from me, and I was better off under the pier with the long stick and the rats, because there were guys up on the top of the pier with guns looking for me because I'd stolen somebody's stuff and eaten it, sold it, lost it, who knows what, took it, whatever. See? And so this was none of the stuff that I was going to tell anybody because you people were clean. And what happened was you're only as sick as your secrets. And what happened to me is I nearly killed myself because I would not tell you my secrets. And what happened was the only thing that saved my ass and saved my life was the fact that I kept coming to AA even when I was drunk. And they pulled me out of meetings a couple of times and said, shut up. They told me I could stay as long as I was quiet. But one time some guy came in and some idiot picked on a guy they didn't even know and said, you be the leader. And he inadvertently called on me. And like I said, I was a fixture in that club. Drunk or sober, I was a fixture. And what happened was I got up and I was so mad. I was never insulted that you didn't call on me. I understood. But I was so mad because here I was drunk again. Anyway, I stood up on the chair in the middle of this meeting and I told them who was sleeping with who and who was still smoking marijuana. And I told them who was not paying the alimony because I heard all the gossip. And what I did was I pulled everybody's blankets and I said to myself, good, now they're going to throw me out. And what they did was when I got down and sat down, they all clapped and he called on the next person. I I couldn't make you throw me away. You didn't want much to do with me, but I couldn't make you throw me away. And one time there was a lady there. I was sitting in the half measures room because I'd reached the point where, you know, it was sort of like brain dead. It was brain dead. It really was brain dead. I was sitting there, and nobody talked to me anymore. There wasn't much left. I wasn't quick. I wasn't witty. I wasn't pretty. I wasn't cute. I was, I guess, human. I don't know. Maybe on the outside. And this woman came in with this really cute little newcomer. She said to her, "You see that?" And she pointed at me, and the girl said, "Yeah." She said, "You better work the steps." That's what I was. I was a good, bad example. And one time there was this lady standing there in the middle of the meet, at the middle of the floor, and everybody was putting chairs away after meeting, and I hated her. I hated her with such vehemence. Every time I saw her, I would lose my breath. She was pretty. She had an old man. She had people around her that liked her. When she spoke at a meeting, you could hear a pin drop. When I spoke, which, you know, in the beginning I did, it was like somebody said, "Coffee break." I hated her. And you know the thing is that she was smiling when nobody was watching. And I noticed that. And I went up to her, and I had to confront her. I really did. And I said to her, "Dottie," she looked at me, and I said, "Will you be my sponsor?" That might have come out of my mouth, but I didn't say it. And she looked at me and she said, "God, Franny, I don't know, you're a loser." And, you know, somehow or other, right at that moment, I knew I could not move away from her. It still generates energy for me when I talk about this, because what I did was I looked at her and she just simply stood there looking at me. She did not make it easy. And I said what I hadn't said in 25 years. I said, "Please." And she said, "Well," she put her hand out, one of her lieutenants gave her a directory. She took it and she... and she marked the meeting she went to. She said, "I'll see you there." And my God. And she walked away. I had a sponsor. I didn't know what to do with her, but I had a sponsor. So for 6 months, I stayed on the other side of the room for her and never said a word. But I showed up. And I used to say to people, "That's my sponsor." Because she was famous. Everybody knew, you know. And one day she called me up and she said, "How are you?" And I said, I'd been crying. I had my head under the pillow. She said, "How are you?" And I said, "Fine." She said, "You're a liar, cheat, and a thief." She says, "Get over to my house and let's start teaching you how to live sober." So I got myself dressed and I went over to her house and she said to me, "When did you quit taking speed?" See, what I'd done is I started taking speed when I was 13 years old and I'd been taking it right up. And I got sober right at the time where we had the good old boy saying things like, "And we will not discuss drugs in AA meetings." And I said, "Right, we won't." So I never told anybody. But she knew. She said, "When did you quit taking the speed?" I said, She said, "Are you taking speed anymore?" I said, "No." She said, "When did you quit taking it?" "Today." She said, "Sit down. Just hang out here, watch what we do." And what I did was I hung out with her and I started watching her. And what I found out was that I had inadvertently wandered into a nest of step Nazis. It was horrendous. They wouldn't talk to me unless I talked program. They wouldn't let me say anything at the meetings unless I had something relevant to talk about. They didn't want to hear any of my funny stories, and they didn't want to hear my babble, and they didn't want to hear my resentments. They wanted me to talk program, and that meant that I had to start getting into the book, and I had to start working the steps, and what happened was I did. And after I had the third step down, after I'd taken the third step, I was so excited because I suddenly realized
I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. And I it was like somebody filled me up with light. And I went to her and I said, my God, I am so full of whatever the hell this is. I don't know what to do with myself. I thought she would send me off to China to save alcoholic souls or something, you know. And she said, why don't you go home and do your dishes? And I stormed out of her house. And I said, I'll show her. And I went home and I looked at my sink. And I mean, there was green stuff on the top. And I know there were things that were alive underneath, you know. And I figured, well, hell. So I went, my daughter kept herself clean. And I don't know, I found some Comet someplace. And I was scraped and cleaned. And I had these big double laundry sinks. And anyway, I washed and I smashed. And I washed and I smashed. And I washed and I smashed. So that, yeah, they were clean, but they were broken. And I was the kind of person, this was very typical for me, because I was the kind of drunk that would say, who are you? You're telling me I'm drunk? Stick around for an hour. I'll show you drunk. You know that one? Well, I say, all right. You want my dishes clean? Stick around. I'll show you clean. Pulverized, but clean. And what I did was I cleaned up the sink, and you know, I looked at it. And I took the Comet, and I scrubbed it out. And I rinsed it. It's the first and only time I dried a sink. And I stood there looking at it, and I thought to myself, I got a clean sink. So I went to the meeting to that night, and when they called on me, I said, my name's Franny, and I'm an alcoholic, and I got a clean sink. And she wasn't there. So I called her up. I said, Dottie, I have something to say to you. She says, yeah. I said, I have a clean sink. She said, good, do it again tomorrow. And what had happened with that was that it, by giving me those little tasks that I never absolutely saw, I mean, what has a clean sink got to do with alcoholism? Plenty. Because what it did was it gave me, in a very small way, the beginning of the self-respect that this program gave back to me as a woman, as a human being. The next time she saw me, Jim Blackwell was there, and he said to me, you know, I think you'd be pretty if you washed your hair. Hey, I'm the lady with the sweatshirts, front, back, inside, out, front, back. I didn't say anything about baths in between, did I? And what happened was, when I had about, I don't know, maybe 6 months of sobriety, maybe three, I don't know, A couple of my girlfriends, two girlfriends and myself, we went out. We had to borrow everything because none of us had anything, but we got ourselves all gussied up and we went to a dance. And we were clean and we sniffed each other. We smelled good. We borrowed perfume and I had somebody's skirt on or slacks or and a shirt and, you know, I borrowed Janet's makeup and she was a redhead. It was absolutely inappropriate. I looked like I was bleeding to death from the mouth, but that didn't matter. You know, I was very pleased with myself. I really was. I was like, hey, I'm here. And after the dance, we stopped by Dan and Dottie's house to show them how good we looked. And Dan was sitting at the dining room table working on some paperwork when we came sashaying in all our sober glory. And he looked at us and he said, there they are, slick, trick, and sick. We didn't care. We were pretty slick, pretty sick, and pretty trick. But it didn't matter. I mean, we were proud of ourselves. And another time I went to Dottie, you know, we used to tease each other. We had an awful lot of young guys and a lot of young gals in our group. And we used to call it Incest Anonymous because it was, everybody was laying everybody. I mean, it was just, that's the way it went. And nobody was looking, like I said, 2 months plus 10 months makes a year. Okay, let's go. You know, and so what happened was, I went to Dottie and I said to her early on, I said, Janet's got a boyfriend. Susie's got a boyfriend. Ellie's got a boyfriend. Everybody's out there getting laid. Where's mine? She looked me right in the eye and she said, Franny, as sick as you are, any guy that's interested in you isn't worth your time. And I said to her, must I remain celibate for the rest of my life? And she said, maybe. And I thought, well, she said, but look, she said, God's giving you the time to work on the steps. And she says, the problem with you is you're too smart for your own good. And I have gone to her and I said, Dottie, you know, I'm getting scared because this says people who are incapable of being honest die. And she said, you know, if you would only read the black part of the page instead of the white, she said, I will live longer. But she said, look at this. It only says their chances are less than average. And she said, yes, it's true. You are a psychopath. Your chance is less than average. But it doesn't mean you can't make it. So I said, what do I have to do? She says, you have to get into the steps and you have to work like hell. And she says, and forget the extraneous stuff. She says, you need to learn. She said, if you be a good enough human being, maybe God will give you a soul. I thought, wow, I could negotiate that one. You know? And so what I did was I really started working a program. And that's what, you know, like I told you when I got into the third step. And what happened was I had 9 months sobriety and this little Indian broad came walking up to me and she said, I want you to be my sponsor. And my only response to that was, my God, this one has got to be sick. And I went to my sponsor and I said, what do I do now? Becky wants me to be her sponsor. She said, fine. She said, you stay one step ahead of her and she'll never know the difference. So I did. And what happened was I wound up sponsoring a whole bunch of other people. And what I noticed is that there are fewer women that come into the program, which is bad odds, because there is no, alcoholism strikes everybody, and there is no, you know, discrimination in it. But the thing that happens is that fewer women get into the program and fewer women than that make it. And one of the reasons is because they come in and they look for a man to be their higher power. See, when we're out on the streets, we look for Uncle Daddy to fix it, right? And I gotta tell you something, if nobody's told you, when a woman or a man comes into this program, the game remains the same. The only thing they do is they clean up, they sober up, right? But they don't stop the games until they find out they don't work. And if they're not surrounded by people that have some kind of principles, how the hell are they gonna learn them? So what happens is you go into these goddamn clubs, and the guys, I saw it just the other night, I was at a meeting, a new English girl, and she had 2 days, and after the meeting, there were 6 men standing around her. And I said to myself, will you look at that? And one of my babies walked up and said, excuse me, gentlemen. And she pushed them aside, and I went, right on, Donnie's. You know? And I'm not telling you that because I want to save the women's lives. I'm telling you that because the cutest little cookies that ever come in here, I'm going to tell you, are baby barracudas. And the women know it. Women are survivors. And what happens is they got these teeth. And so these dumb men guys, I understand. But you go up to these cuties and they say, oh, I really need a man to take care of me. Listen, take a look at them. They got $35 manicures and $70 haircuts. And all they want is somebody to maintain the style. So what happens is Uncle Daddy steps in and takes her. And he takes good care of her for about a year. But in the meantime, she's going to meetings and he's her higher power. And then one day she looks at him. And she's worked through the steps now in her own inimitable way. But sufficient to look at this guy and say, hey, you know what? You're a cripple shooter. You scooped me up and you didn't give me a chance to develop my own program. And all of a sudden I'm looking at you and you know what? I don't want to be a cripple anymore. And sayonara. And she leaves and she hooks herself in with some dragon lady sponsor. I've had men that were stupid enough to bring their women to me. And they say to me, fix her. And I look at them and I say, do you realize what that entails? I don't care. She's crazy. Okay. But anyway, what happens is they get this dragon lady sponsor, and all of a sudden they wind up finding out that the women have a power of their own, and it's wonderful. You know? But it's got, you have to give women, the new women, permission to find the women that have power. All women have it. And what happens is if you guys hold on to it, You're only screwing yourselves over because they're going to leave you in the dust. And that's not what I want. When I'm telling you saying that to defend the women, I'm saying that to defend the men. It's important. You've got to know that. It took me two marriages in the program. First guy I got involved with when I was about 4 or 6 months sober. And one day I looked at him and I said, is that all there is? And he said, yeah. I said, you know what? It's not enough. And I walked away. And the second one has the kind of program, I don't push him around. I try. But I don't push him around. And what happens is he's my best friend. And you know, I've got a whole bunch of people that are in my life today, and we share the joy. Because, you know, if you plant a little tree, you're not pulling it up every day to check the roots, are you? You know? This program is not about introspection. This program is about working the steps and get out there and have some fun. This program is about finding out what is out there in the world that you want and being willing to pay the price and go for it. And this program is not about avoiding mistakes. I know so many people who think that when they get sober, they're never going to make mistakes. Wrong. A mistake is a learning situation. And that's all it is. Just don't do it again the same way. Change it. Make another mistake. And what happens is today, I have all these people on this side that I'm sponsoring that I just love and I learn from. And I have all the people on this side that I look at, you know, the ones that have the experience, and I'm holding on like this, you know? And I tell you, I'm a little tiny link in the chain that goes around the world. You hold on like that, you can't fall down. Thank you.